only the first price break from the highs. After you get out, why not re-enter from the short side on a bounce? The very fact that you committed to a major short position is itself an indication that when the market does break, it is likely to carry on for some time and some distance. If you went back and checked those trades where you took a maximum position, anticipating a major market reversal, I would bet that in every case, the market kept on going after it finally broke. That's 100% true. I understand that, and yet I don't have the patience to sit there every day with the same positions. The next level down is something that I don't have the trust to stay with. But that trust should come from your own prior conviction to put on a maximum position before the market turned. The very fact that you were in that trade is itself a great indicator that the trend will likely continue in the other direction once the market has broken. You have this great indicator, not an indicator on a chart, but an internal radar that identifies potential major market turning points. You also have a talent for trading in and out of a position. Why not combine those skills? Take, for example, the commodity peak in 2008. You anticipated that top, went short in the last stage of the rally, and then took your profits on the first break after the highs. Why not at that point say, this market was way overdone, it's going to keep going down for a while, I'm going to get back short on a rally? Then you would be trading both in sync with your original prognostication and with the trend. And if you combine that positional bias with your skill in trading in and out of the market, you would open up a whole source of additional profit potential that you are leaving on the table. It seems to me to be such an obvious thing to do. It seems like the opportunity that you haven't taken is tailor-made for your set of skills. It's like you are currently trading with two hands tied behind your back. You are trading these ideas when the trend is strongly against you, but once the market turns and the trend is in your direction, you go on and do something else. Look, Jack, I know that, and I want to have those types of trades because I'm right there. What part of my thought process is shutting out those trades? I don't know. Maybe I'm just comfortable being comfortable, and trading with the trend would require me being uncomfortable. The part of the price move where everyone is freaking out and my boss is freaking out is where I am at ease. I am very comfortable when panic is set in because I know then, I got them, they're trapped. That's ironic because what you consider comfortable, selling into a near vertical rally, is exactly what most people would find highly uncomfortable. Maybe that is where the fun of it is for me. And yet, where I am making most of my money is in the short-term trading around my positions. That's exactly my point. Why not put the two together? Why not combine that short-term trading with positions that are in line with your original directional call after the market has confirmed the turn you expected? I'm not suggesting you give up doing any trade you do. All I'm saying is why not add that other component? When you have that really strong feeling and then the market does break, the odds are that the trend will continue for a while. It always does. Those huge opportunities in my career were probably $50 million trades, but I took all the risk and maybe only made $3 million, when just a few weeks later it would have been a $10 million profit, and a few months later $25 million. I hope in my career I will make those trades sometimes. I know I will have the opportunity. Do stock upgrades or downgrades figure into your trading? Generally, the stocks that I am short are being upgraded, and the stocks that I am long are being downgraded. That's how Wall Street works. They're always pushing it when things are great, and they're always selling it when things are bad. They don't impact my trading. Do you still see yourself trading 10 years from now? I think trading will always be a part of me, but I don't think it will be a 9-to-4 thing. But ironically, the very style that has brought you success, continuously trading in and out of positions, almost by definition seems to necessitate your sitting in front of the screen all day. So far, yes. But even in the last 2 years, and Zach can attest to this, I will step away from the screen to go to meetings. That is a way of bridging myself to a world that doesn't have me only in front of my screens. What are your goals? I want to continue to learn. I want to be a great businessman. I'm involved in a lot of other businesses outside investments that I have made. What other businesses are you involved in? Video games, clean tech, movie post-production, and healthcare. How does trading fit into it? Trading is my source of funds. How do you see your trading evolving over time? I really can't imagine myself sitting in front of the screens for the rest of my life. Wouldn't it be hard to step away from something that you are so good at? I started stepping away part-time and doing other things 4 years ago. It has been a slow process because trading is something I am good at, and it comes relatively easy to me. But sitting in front of screens is very limiting when there are so many other things that interest me. This was my first job. I want to let go of the shackles. I know there is so much more of life that I can experience and engage in, but the only way I can do that is by stepping away. I feel this interview should contain the type of warning that accompanies TV footage of dangerous stunts. Don't try this at home. The truth is that Baladimus' style is so highly individualistic, so dependent on innate talent, and so poorly attuned to most traders that, as a generalization, they would be better off doing the exact opposite than trying to emulate his approach. Of all the traders I have ever interviewed for any of the Market Wizard books, none has provided a more difficult role model from which to draw lessons applicable to most traders. There are, however, three lessons that can be drawn from Baladimus' story that do have more general applicability without potential lethal side effects. The need to adapt. While the commonality of human nature provides elements of consistency in market behavior across time, markets also change, and successful traders adapt to that change. In the case of Baladimus, he noticed that the much greater level of market participation by hedge funds was resulting in smoother price moves for individual stocks and far fewer pullbacks, particularly intraday. This structural change in the market made it more difficult for Baladimus to offset losses from being too early in a position, with profits from trading around the position. It became more important not to be too early on trades. Baladimus responded by keeping positions smaller until there was a market change that gave him a high degree of confidence that a turning point was imminent. Even though very few listeners will be able to relate to Baladimus's trading strategy, the idea that trading methods need to be adapted to changing market conditions is an important concept that can be applied to each trader's specific approach. Trading around a position. A key element in Baladimus's trading success is adjusting position size counter to market fluctuations. For example, if he is short, he will reduce his position on price breaks and rebuild the position on rallies. Baladimus is so skillful at trading around positions that he's often able to generate net profits even when the net price movement of a stock over time is counter to his position. Although Baladimus's timing for this type of trading is an innate skill that cannot be translated, and one that few traders will be able to match, many traders may nevertheless find that trading around a position improves performance and makes it easier to hold on to winning trades. As a simple example, assume you are a long stock at 50, looking for a long-term objective of 76, and expecting near-term resistance in the vicinity of 62. Given these assumptions, you might choose to reduce long exposures on advance to the 61 to the 63 zone, looking to reinstate the full position on a pullback. The potential drawback is that a retracement to the re-entry level may fail to occur, in which case profits will be realized on a smaller position. On the positive side, if the liquidated portion of the position is re-entered at a better price, total profits will be enhanced, and perhaps even more importantly, the ability to hold the position will be improved. Whether trading around positions is net beneficial or detrimental will be highly contingent on the individual trader. It will not necessarily be a good fit for all traders, but some traders may find it a highly useful approach. Avoid euphoria. Even though it has worked well for Baladimus for a long time, the last thing I would advise traders to do would be to sell into panic rallies. Very few traders will possess the innate timing skill and emotional stamina to pull this off successfully, and the cost of being wrong can be extreme. Still, for those who are on the right side of a market that accelerates into a parabolic move, it may well make sense to take partial or total profits while the market is in a panic state, rather than waiting for a reversal, which in these types of markets can be both abrupt and extreme when it does come. In short, if you are long a market that you would be petrified to sell, it may not be a bad idea to get smaller or get out. Some listeners will finish this chapter and think, Baladimus has just been lucky. You can't trade that way and get away with it. He will eventually step on a landmine. Well, Baladimus has stepped on a landmine, many in fact, but it hasn't stopped his consistent forward momentum. Think about it. Baladimus averages hundreds of trades a day and has been trading for 15 years through multiple bull and bear market phases. What are the odds of consistent superior performance with this frequency of trading on the basis of luck alone? Such an outcome would border on statistical impossibility. As successful as Baladimus has been, from my objective perspective, it seemed that he wasn't applying his methodology to its full potential. Specifically, the markets he anticipates will be major tops and bottoms and variably trend for a long time once they reverse. Yet despite this consistent pattern and his skill in identifying these major turning points before they happen, he only trades a small part of the ensuing trend. It seemed obvious to me that he could further improve his performance by simply trading these markets for a much longer time, a conclusion with which he agreed. The point is that even the best traders may not be executing their strategies in the best way. Any trader that has an edge, as Baladimas clearly does, should consider whether the trading methodology being employed is best aligned with that edge. I am frequently asked whether becoming a market wizard is a matter of innate talent or hard work. My standard answer is to use a running analogy. As intimidating as the task may seem to those physically unconditioned, most people can run a marathon given sufficient training and dedication. But only the small minority born with the right physical characteristics will ever be able to run a 2:15 men or 2:30 women time, regardless of how hard they work. The analogy for trading is that similar to running a marathon. Proficiency is achievable with hard work, but performing at an elite level requires some degree of innate talent. Baladimas provides a good example. Sure, he was extremely dedicated to succeeding as a trader and willing to work long hours with full focus on trading, but his level of trading success was only possible because he has some innate skill, some inner radar, that gives him a sense of what markets will do. I don't care how devoted someone is to trading or how many hours they are willing to watch trading screens. The reality is that this type of skill will be out of reach for most people. There is no single true path to trading success. On the contrary, the trading methodologies employed by market wizards are extraordinarily varied. The trading approaches used are not merely different, but in the case of someone like Jimmy Baladimas, the trading methodology may be closer to a mirror image of what other traders do than bearing any similarity. Aspiring traders need to understand that the quest is not a matter of finding that one approach that unlocks the secrets of market success, but rather finding an approach that fits their personality. Jimmy Baladimas has found an approach that works for him because it fits his personality: independent, competitive, contrarian, and very comfortable with risk. The same approach, however, would be potentially disastrous for most other traders who would have very different comfort levels and trading style. Over the years, I have received many inquiries that read something like the following. Dear Mr. Schwager, I wonder whether you know of any traders who are looking for apprentices. I'm willing to work long hours without pay to be able to learn from one of the market wizards. This type of query reflects a misdirected quest. You cannot succeed in the markets by copying someone else's approach, because the odds are remote that their method will fit your personality. The answer lies not in copying someone else's method, but in finding your own.
Chapter 15. Joel Greenblatt, The Magic Formula. Joel Greenblatt's name came up several times when I called hedge fund managers I knew for their recommendations on who I should consider including in a new market wizard's book. One manager said, "He wrote this book, you can be a stock market genius." Responding to my muffled groan, he said, "Yeah, I know the title, but it's really a great book. I think that book got a lot of hedge fund managers in the business." I subsequently read the book and found it covered the esoteric subject of special situation trading: spin-offs, mergers, restructurings, rights offerings, stub stocks, warrants, etc. With surprising conciseness, clarity, and even a sense of humor. In the appendix, Greenblatt provided the track record for his fund, Gotham Capital. The record began in 1985 and stopped abruptly in 1994. The average annualized compounded return was exactly 50.0% before incentive fees. The outperformance was remarkably consistent. The lowest annual return during the entire 10-year period was positive 28.5%. It was one of the best track records I had ever seen. Why, I wondered, would anyone close a fund that was doing so remarkably well? Since it was clear from his books that Greenblatt remained active in the markets, I couldn't even guess at a plausible explanation for closing the fund. The answer, it turned out, was both logical and obvious once you knew it. Greenblatt closed his fund precisely because it did so well. Assets had grown to the point where they were impeding returns, so Greenblatt decided to return all investor money. Greenblatt, along with Rob Goldstein, his partner since 1989, continued to trade the Gotham Capital account with their own capital for more than another decade, using the same concentrated portfolio of special situation trades as they did in the fund, the types of trades Greenblatt detailed in You Can Be a Stock Market Genius. The returns for this proprietary account are not available. Off the record, Greenblatt did tell me the average return for the account subsequent to the return of investor money. Let's just say that Gotham continued to do extremely well, far better than the vast majority of hedge funds, although not approaching the lofty average return of the terminated fund. Greenblatt's second book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, the man is not timid when it comes to titles, grew out of a research project. In 2003, he hired a programmer to test how two key metrics that together were representative of his investment selection criteria, picking companies that were cheap and good, actually performed in the markets. Greenblatt used earnings yield to represent cheapness and return on capital to represent goodness. The two measures were combined in a single ranking that worked even better than Greenblatt and Goldstein expected. Greenblatt named this combined ranking indicator the magic formula, a name that implicitly pokes fun at the hype accompanying market indicators, but also acknowledges the surprising efficacy of the measure as empirically demonstrated. In fact, Greenblatt and Goldstein were so impressed with the magic formula that they set up an eponymous website to use it as the basis for managing stock portfolios. The success of the initial research project led to a major expansion of the research endeavor in which Gotham spent tens of millions to develop and test a more sophisticated construction and application of value indicators. The proprietary indicators used were conceptually similar to the magic formula, but were considerably more complex and yielded more accurate measures of value. The results were so good that the partners shifted Gotham's money management methodology from a concentrated special situations focus to a diversified systematic value approach. The new diversified approach also had much greater capacity, effectively removing the reason that had prompted the return of investor capital in the original Gotham Fund. In 2009, Gotham returned to the world of money management, launching two long-short funds, one large cap and one small to mid cap. So 15 years after having returned investor money and believing himself to be permanently out of the money management business, Greenblatt, in coordination with Goldstein and a team of 10 research analysts, found himself once again managing investor money based on the same core principles. This time, however, the trading was based on a diversified systematic methodology instead of the original approach, which yielded a concentrated portfolio of value and special situation stocks. Greenblatt and his team at Gotham next applied the systematic value approach to the task of constructing value-weighted indexes, which appear to substantially outperform all existing types of equity indexes. Gotham has launched several funds and separately traded managed accounts trading these new generation value-weighted indexes in both U.S. equities and international equities, with the funds segmented by cap size. The funds trading these new generation indexes provide mutual fund and institutional equity index investors with a seemingly much better investment alternative. This new investment vehicle is the big secret in Greenblatt's third book, The Big Secret for the Small Investor. Greenblatt believes that it's just a matter of time before other mutual funds begin copying this innovative approach, but that Gotham's proprietary research capabilities and process should continue to provide superior performance versus competitors.
When you were young, did you have any idea what you wanted to do with your life?
Probably not. I had a better idea of what I didn't want to do. I got an MBA and then went to law school primarily because I didn't want to get an investment banking job working 90 to 100 hours a week. But I dropped out after 1 year when I realized I had no interest in being a lawyer.
What got you interested in the stock market?
In my junior year in college, I read an article in Forbes about Ben Graham. A light bulb went off, and I started reading everything I could find on Ben Graham. In college, we were taught the efficient market hypothesis, which wasn't very appealing to me. The theory didn't coincide logically with what I saw going on in the market. There were lots of stocks that doubled or halved during the course of 1 year. The premise that these stocks were efficiently priced at all of the prices between their highs and lows seemed implausible to me. When I read Graham, I thought to myself, that is so logical. Stocks fluctuate around fair value over time.
Did you have any interest in the market before that point?
I had an interest in horse racing and dog racing more than in the stock market.
Did you go to the track?
I went to the track when I could get in, usually the dog track because they weren't very stern about keeping you from sneaking in.
Did you have any methodology in betting?
Unfortunately, I didn't. I'll never forget my first big bet. One time I went to the track with my cousin and I found a dog who had run 12 seconds faster than all the other dogs. But for some inexplicable reason, the odds against him were 99-1. That seemed like a great bet to me. I didn't know why the other gamblers were so stupid. The dog finished dead last. After the race, I found out that the dog had run 12 seconds faster at a much shorter distance, and that this was his first time running a longer distance. That experience taught me a quick lesson that I had to do more research.
When did you first start investing in stocks?
After I read about Ben Graham and before going off to law school, I started a fund buying what Graham called net-nets, stocks trading below their liquidation value. I did a study on stocks selling below their liquidation value, which eventually turned into my master's thesis. I worked with two of my friends from business school, Richard Zena and Bruce Newberg. We didn't have money for a database. The university library had the S&P stock guides for the past 10 years or so. We manually collected the data from the guides. We only looked at about 15% of the stock universe because it was pretty mind-numbing getting the data by hand. At the time, the University of Pennsylvania had a DEC-10 computer, which was about 4 times the size of this room, and probably had less power than today's smartphone. Richard was pretty good with computers. We put all our data into the computer and found that Graham's formula, which he had written about many years earlier, still worked extremely well. The portfolios we put together using Graham's principles did much better than the indexes. The study got published in the Journal of Portfolio Management in the summer of 1981. Before going off to law school, I started a fund to buy stocks selling below their liquidation value with $250,000 that I had raised from my father's friends.
How long did you manage that fund?
For about 2 to 3 years. When I had my first full-time job, it was suggested to me that it was not appropriate to keep the fund running.
How did the fund do?
It made 44% cumulatively.
Since you had gotten off to such a good start with the fund, did you consider the possibility of building that into a career instead of getting a job?
I thought I had more to learn. It was a good experience managing other people's money and knowing what that felt like.
What was your first investment-based job?
After my first and only year at law school, I took a summer job trading options at Bear Stearns.
Did you know anything about options at that point?
No, I ended up doing forward conversions, which are a riskless arbitrage. The idea was to put on these arbitrage trades and earn 18 to 19% annualized.
The option market was that inefficient at the time?
No, interest rates were that high at the time. I think that arbitrage added about 5% to 6% to the risk-free rate. Frankly, the trading was kind of mechanical. At the time, you didn't have the option prices on the screen in front of you. I had to run to the other side of the floor to get a printout of option prices to see what options were setting up attractively relative to the stock. Then I would run back to my desk to try to execute the trade. Although it was interesting learning about options, by the end of the summer, I knew that I had no interest in trading options for a living.
What did you do after the summer job?
I got a job as an analyst for a startup risk arbitrage firm called Halcyon Investments. There were 3 partners, and I was the only analyst. They offered me $22,000, which was about half the going rate for MBAs at the time. I jumped at it because I loved the idea of being the only analyst in a startup firm. I thought I could learn a lot.
Wasn't the fact that you had no experience at all in merger arbitrage an impediment to getting the job?
Well, at $22,000, they clearly weren't willing to spend much money and weren't looking for an experienced analyst. I hope they were just looking for someone with potential.
What year was this?
I started December 1981.
Ironically, you began your career right before a major bottom in the stock market.
It was interesting. At that time, not many people were looking to go to Wall Street because the market hadn't gone up for 13 years.
What were your experiences in your first job?
At the time, merger arbitrage was the Wild West. There were great inefficiencies and plenty of opportunities, so that even a pedestrian year might be a 60% to 80% return.
Was this just doing plain vanilla merger arbitrage?
We did do straight risk arbitrage, and there were wide spreads available. But I was never that attracted to the risk/reward in risk arbitrage. In the Ben Graham approach, if you pay a cheap price for something, you have asymmetric returns on the upside because you can't lose that much, but you still have large profit potential. Risk arbitrage is exactly the opposite. In risk arbitrage, you're trying to make $1 or $2 if the merger goes through, but risking $10 or $20 if the deal breaks. Instinctively, I didn't like those odds, even though, on average, If you had a lot of deals, it paid off well. I was always attracted to the periphery of risk arbitrage, such as hostile deals, meaning another bidder was coming in, or deals where there were interesting pieces of paper being offered instead of cash. The fact that I understood options because of my summer job at Bear Stearns was also very helpful. In risk arbitrage, timing is very important. When is the deal going to close? If you have some edge in answering that question, you could gain leverage by using options that expire at a certain time. Also, by knowing the price at which a deal was going to close, you could find opportunities and options which were critically dependent on price and which might be mispriced because the merger distorted the normal probability distribution assumption implicit in option prices. You could also use options to hedge deals that might break. There were so many interesting combinations.
Did you get involved in other event-driven types of trades as well?
We did some at Halcyon, but when I started out on my own, I was very attracted to special situation trades where there was something going on in the business and the usual rules didn't apply. It might be a spin-off or a new piece of paper being issued or a recapitalization or a two-tiered tender offer, situations that the typical Wall Street analyst was not equipped to evaluate. I liked complicated situations. If there was a 400-page document to read, I was attracted to analyzing the deal because I knew most other people wouldn't read it.
How did you go from your job as an analyst at Halcyon to starting your own fund?
One of my friends, Bruce Newberg, who was one of the co-authors for the paper we wrote for the Journal of Portfolio Management, worked for Mike Milken. One day after I had been at Halcyon for about 3 years, I was talking to Bruce on the phone and happened to mention that if I could raise several million, I would go out on my own. Bruce called me back the next day and said, "Mike said fine." Milken ended up offering to invest twice what I had asked for, but I only wanted to start with $7 million. I had been trading my own account while I was at Halcyon and making over 100% a year.
I wanted to make sure I could run the fund the same way as my personal account, and I didn't want to start off too large. Can you give me an example of the types of trades you did in your original fund, which had a special situations focus?
One interesting example was a Marriott spinoff. Marriott got caught in the real estate downdraft of the early 1990s. Marriott's primary business was hotel management, and they got stuck owning a lot of the underlying hotels, which they usually tried to sell off. So they spun off the hotels and the debt that accompanied the hotels into a new company, Host Marriott, and kept the good business, Marriott International. The main business, the hotel management, was actually a Buffett type of business, and it was being relieved of all its debt. So it was a very clever transaction. But what I was most attracted to was what I call the toxic waste of the transaction, Host Marriott, which was the heavily leveraged out-of-favor part of the business that no one wanted at the time.
What attracted you to it?
The first thing that attracted me to it was that it was clearly unwanted by anyone who could read either the newspaper or a balance sheet. I thought no one else was going to pay any attention to it because it looked so ugly, so it might be fertile ground for me to explore. Also, I thought institutions would likely sell off their shares in the spinoff because it represented only 10 to 15% of the original company and would probably be too small a cap size for them to hold. The spinoff was also in a different business. Most people investing in the parent, Marriott International, were interested in the hotel management business, so they would discard Host Marriott, which was in a different business, hotel ownership. The lack of new buying interest and the likelihood that many of the Marriott shareholders would sell off their shares in the spinoff meant that there was a good chance that Host Marriott would end up being undervalued. It certainly meant it was worth taking a close look at.
So what did you find?
I found that insiders had a large stake in the spinoff. The guy who masterminded the spinoff was actually going to run the bad business. It didn't make sense that he would choose to go with the spinoff if it was really as bad as the press reports made it sound. Also, the Marriott family was retaining 25% ownership in Host Marriott. I also discovered that Host Marriott provided tremendous leverage. It was expected to trade at about $3 to $5 per share with debt of about $20 to $25. For illustration, assuming a share price of $5 and a debt of $25 would imply the assets of the new company would be worth about $30. The low share price relative to the company value meant a 15% increase in value of the assets would nearly double the value of the stock. Of course, leverage could work the other way, but the upside potential was lopsided relative to the downside risk. The stock can't go below zero. Also, given the large insider ownership, I didn't think it was likely that the deal would be structured for host Marriott to fail. In addition, the deal required that Marriott International, the good Marriott, extend a $600 million line of credit to host Marriott.
What ultimately happened?
As expected, most institutions dumped their shares at a low price. The stock then nearly tripled in 4 months.
Can you give me another example of a special situations trade that illustrates your approach?
In the early 1990s, Wells Fargo, which had an excellent long-term, consistent fee-generating business, came under a lot of pressure because of its high concentration of commercial real estate loans in California, at a time when California was in the midst of a deep real estate recession. There was a possibility, although unlikely, that the real estate downturn could be so severe that Wells Fargo would go through all its equity before investors could get the benefit of their long-term fee generation. If it survived, though, the stock would likely be much higher than its current depressed price of $80, which reflected the prevailing concerns. The way I looked at the risk/reward of the stock was that it was a binary situation. The stock would go down $80 if Wells Fargo went out of business, and up $80 if it didn't. But by buying leaps, with more than 2 years until expiration instead of the stock, I could turn that 1-to-1 risk/reward into a 1-to-5 risk/reward. If the bank survived, the stock should be a double, and I would make 5 times my money on the options, but if it failed, I would lose only the cost of the options. I thought the odds were much better than 50-50 that the bank would survive. So the stock was a buy. But in terms of risk/reward, the options were an even better buy. The stock did end up more than doubling before the options expired.
How long did you continue to trade the same general strategy as you did in the hedge fund after returning money to investors in 1995?
For about 10 years. Then we gradually transitioned to investing using a systematic value approach.
Why the change?
It wasn't a change in investment principles. I've always been a value investor. The Gotham Capital Fund and Gotham Capital, subsequent to returning outside capital, held a concentrated portfolio of both straight value positions, that is, value positions without an obvious catalyst, and positions in special situations, which are more catalyst-driven trades. The transition to what we're doing now came about because I always wanted to test the principles I had been teaching and using to manage money. In 2003, Rob Goldstein and I hired a skilled computer programmer so that we could backtest some of the key measures we look at when we evaluate a company. The first metric we tested was based on Ben Graham's principle of buying cheap.
How did you define cheap?
There are a lot of ways of measuring cheapness. We use the earnings yield, which we defined as the ratio of earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT, to enterprise value. In his book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, Greenblatt provided the following explanation of earnings yield. Earnings yield was measured by calculating the ratio of pre-tax operating earnings, EBIT, to enterprise value, market value of equity, plus net interest-bearing debt. This ratio was used rather than the more commonly used P.E. ratio, price-earnings ratio, or E.P. ratio, earnings-price ratio, for several reasons. The basic idea behind the concept of earnings yield is to simply figure out how much a business earns relative to the purchase price of the business. Enterprise value was used instead of merely the price of equity, i.e. total market capitalization, share price multiplied by shares outstanding, because enterprise value takes into account both the price paid for an equity stake in a business, as well as the debt financing used by a company to help generate operating earnings. By using EBIT, which looks at actual operating earnings before interest expenses and taxes, and comparing it to enterprise value, we can calculate the pre-tax earnings yield on the full purchase price of the business, i.e. pre-tax operating earnings relative to the price of equity plus any debt assumed. This allows us to put companies with different levels of debt and different tax rates on equal footing when comparing earnings yields. For example, in the case of an office building purchased for $1 million with an $800,000 mortgage and $200,000 in equity, the price of equity is $200,000, but the enterprise value is $1 million. If the building generates EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, of $100,000, then EBIT, EV, or the pre-tax earnings yield would be 10%, $100,000 over $1 million. However, the use of debt can greatly skew the apparent returns from the purchase of these same assets when only the price of equity is considered. Assuming an interest rate of 6% on an $800,000 mortgage and a 40% corporate tax rate, the pre-tax earnings yield on our equity purchase price of $200,000 would appear to be 26%. As debt levels change, this pre-tax earnings yield on equity would keep changing, yet the $1 million cost of the building and the $100,000 EBIT generated by that building would remain unchanged. In other words, PE and EP are greatly influenced by changes in debt levels and tax rates, while EBIT, EV, is not.
We looked at the 2,500 largest companies in the U.S. In the first test, we ranked the stocks based on the EBIT-EV ratio. We used CompuStat's point-in-time database, which is the actual data that was available as of any given past date, so there is no look-ahead bias. That database starts in 1988, so we started our test from that date. The twist that Warren Buffett put on Graham's method was that it is nice to buy cheap businesses, but if you can buy a good business cheap, that is even better. One of the metrics Buffett used to decide whether a company was a good business was return on tangible capital. In the book, I used an example of Jason's Gum Shop, which cost $400,000 to set up each store, including inventory, displays, and other cost. And every year that store throws off $200,000 in profits, which is a 50% return on capital. Then I compared it to another business called Just Broccoli, which also cost $400,000 to open a new store, but every year that store throws off only $10,000 in profit, or a 2.5% return on capital. Clearly a business that can run 50% on capital is better than a business that can run only 2.5% on capital. Another way to look at it is that every business needs fixed assets and working capital to be in business, and the relevant question is, how efficiently does it turn its fixed assets and working capital into profits? So the second metric we used in our test was return on tangible capital. In his book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, Greenblatt provided the following definition and explanation of return on capital. Return on capital was measured by calculating the ratio of pre-tax operating earnings, EBIT, to tangible capital employed, net working capital plus net fixed assets. This ratio was used rather than the more commonly used ratios of return on equity, ROE, earnings equity, or return on assets, ROA, earnings assets, for several reasons. EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes, was used in place of reported earnings because companies operate with different levels of debt and different tax rates. Using operating earnings before interest and taxes, or EBIT, allowed us to view and compare the operating earnings of different companies without the distortions arising from differences in tax rates and debt levels. For each company, it was then possible to compare actual earnings from operations, EBIT, to the cost of the assets used to produce those earnings, tangible capital employed. Net working capital plus net fixed assets, or tangible capital employed, was used in place of total assets, used in an ROA calculation, or equity, used in an ROE calculation. The idea here was to figure out how much capital is actually needed to conduct the company's business. Net working capital was used because the company has to fund its receivables and inventory. Excess cash not needed to conduct the business was excluded from this calculation, but does not have to lay out money for its payables, as these are effectively an interest-free loan. Short-term interest-bearing debt was excluded from current liabilities for this calculation. In addition to working capital requirements, a company must also fund the purchase of fixed assets necessary to conduct its business, such as real estate, plant, and equipment. The depreciated net cost of these fixed assets was then added to the net working capital requirements already calculated to arrive at an estimate for tangible capital employed. We took the same 2,500 companies and ranked them on their return on capital. We then combined the two rankings, one based on the earnings yield and the other on return on capital. We effectively equally weighted these two measures by adding the two rankings, which gave us the best combination of cheap and good. If a company ranked number one based on earnings yield and 250 based on return on capital, its combined rank value would be 251. We weren't looking for the cheapest companies, and we weren't looking for the best companies. We were looking for the best combination of cheap and good companies. In the book, I call this combined ranking the magic formula. During the 23 years of our back test, using the magic formula to choose a portfolio of the top 30 names from the 1,000 largest capitalization stocks, would have approximately doubled the return of the S&P 500, 19.7% versus 9.5%.
selecting portfolios from the 2,500 largest companies, would have had an even larger outperformance, but would have required holding less liquid smaller-cap stocks. The decade of the 2000s was particularly interesting. During 2000 to 2009, the formula still managed to deliver an average annualized return of 13.5%, even though the S&P 500 was down nearly 1% per year during the same period. The power of value investing flies in the face of anything taught in academics. Value is the way stocks are eventually priced. It requires the perspective of patience because the market will eventually gravitate toward value. We also divided the formula rankings into deciles with 250 stocks in each decile. Then we held those stocks for a year and looked at how each of the deciles did. We repeated this process each month, stepping through time. Each month we had a new set of rankings, and we assumed we held those portfolios, one for each decile, for 1 year. We did that for every month in the last 23 years, beginning with the first month of the CompuStat point-in-time database. It turned out that decile 1 beat decile 2, 2 beat 3, 3 beat 4, and so on all the way down through decile 10, which consisted of bad businesses that were nonetheless expensive. There was a huge spread between decile 1 and decile 10. Decile 1 averaged more than 15% a year, while decile 10 lost an average of 0.2% per year. Since there is such consistency in the relative performance between deciles, wouldn't buying decile 1 stocks and selling decile 10 stocks provide an even better return/risk strategy than simply buying decile 1 stocks? My students in hundreds of emails asked the same question you just did. The typical comment was, "I have a great idea, Joel. Why don't you simply buy decile 1 and short decile 10? You'll make more than 15% a year and you won't have any market risk." There's just one problem with this strategy. Sometime in the year 2000, your shorts would have gone up so much more than your longs that you would have lost 100% of your money. This observation illustrates a very important point. If I wrote a book about a strategy that worked every month, or even every year, everyone would start using it and it would stop working. Value investing doesn't always work. The market doesn't always agree with you. Over time, value is roughly the way the market prices stocks, but over the short term, which sometimes can be as long as 2 or 3 years, there are periods when it doesn't work, and that is a very good thing. The fact that our value approach doesn't work over periods of time is precisely the reason why it continues to work over the long term. Our formula forces you to buy out-of-favor companies, stocks that no one who reads a newspaper would think of buying, and hold a portfolio consisting of these stocks that, at times, may underperform the market for as long as 2 or 3 years. Most people can't stick with a strategy like that. After 1 or 2 years of underperformance, and usually less, they will abandon the strategy, probably switching to a strategy that has done well in recent years. It is very difficult to follow a value approach unless you have sufficient confidence in it. In my books and in my classes, I spend a lot of time trying to get people to understand that, in aggregate, we are buying above-average companies at below-average prices. If that approach makes sense to you, then you will have the confidence to stick with the strategy over the long term, even when it's not working. You will give it a chance to work, but the only way you will stick with something that is not working is by understanding what you are doing. When we got our results showing a perfect ordering of the 10 deciles, my partner Rob Goldstein and I looked at each other and said, "This is pretty interesting." We got these stellar results without trying very hard. We thought that by making further refinements, we might want to manage our own money using a systematic value approach. We now have 10 analysts and go through the income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow statement of each of the companies in our universe, and we figure out what real cash flow is and what real assets and liabilities look like based on the way we analyze companies. We have built our own database for over 4,000 U.S. and foreign stocks.
Forward-looking estimates?
No, we are still looking backward.
How much does this more complex analysis add via the magic formula you presented in your book?
If you are building a diversified portfolio from the entire universe of stocks we follow, it is quite helpful to be using the right numbers, although a diversified group of at least 20 or 30 stocks following either method does quite well.
As good as the systematic value approach works, it still doesn't reach the level of returns you achieved using a concentrated special situations approach in your original fund and the account that you continue to trade, using the same methodology after you returned investor money.
That's true, but when you have only 6 to 8 main positions, and 1 or 2 of them don't work out, you're not very happy. Using our current systematic value approach, we can put together long-short portfolios with hundreds of names on the long side and hundreds of names on the short side that can earn 15 to 20% per year, which compounds very nicely with much less volatility than a portfolio of 6 to 8 names. If I were starting all over again, I would probably still do it in the same way I originally did. But now that I am investing a larger sum of money, I prefer compounding at a good return without assuming the greater volatility that comes with high concentration, even if it means foregoing some extra return. Given this investment preference, the systematic value approach is very appealing. One approach is not better than the other, they are just different. It is an evolution, not a change in process. We have just systematized the same principles we always use to make money. That is what has stayed the same. We are just doing it in a more diversified, methodical way and taking advantage of our team of analysts.
I suppose your current approach can also handle a lot more money.
It can, although that was not the original objective. Our main goal was trying to reduce volatility. People don't fully appreciate the importance of not losing money. Negative compounding is very difficult to overcome. If you lose 50% of your money, you have to make 100% to recover the loss. If you have more volatile returns, that volatility can result in larger losses that are more difficult to make up. If, however, you have a more diversified long-short portfolio, you have a smoother ride and the opportunity to compound your money very well. When we started this research, Rob and I didn't know that it would yield an investment strategy that we would want to work on full-time. The research showed that our approach worked even better than we expected, and that it could be applied effectively to portfolios with hundreds of holdings. These findings led to our launching several long-short funds, as well as several funds with index-like diversification.
Just before, you said that you would have gone broke being short the bottom decile and being long the top decile. What are you doing differently in your long-short funds to avoid that trap?
Rob and I directly manage the risk. Although we have a team of 6 smart technology guys who help us, all smarter than I am, none have any financial background. We purposely picked people who didn't have a financial background because Rob and I wanted to be the portfolio managers. We wanted to create the best portfolio of our longs and shorts subject to various constraints. We wanted to manage our betas on the long and short side. We wanted to limit our concentration in any specific industry group and limit our exposure in any single stock. We have a widely diversified portfolio. In our small cap portfolio, the largest long position is around 0.6% of equity, and the largest short position is even smaller.
How are your long-only equity indexes different from existing indexes?
Most investors have bad choices. 70% of mutual fund managers underperform the market over time, as measured by the S&P 500, primarily because of their fees that reduce the total return. You might think that you could do better by trying to find managers among the 30% that outperform the market. The problem, however, is that there is no correlation between those who did well in the past 3, 5, or 10 years and those who continue to do well in the future. Since investors can't predict which 30% of the managers will do better than the market, the obvious conclusion is to simply go with an index fund, which has lower cost and is tax efficient, and that makes some sense. But it turns out that most popular indexes, such as the S&P 500 and Russell indexes, are very inefficient because they are market capitalization weighted. In a market capitalization weighted index, the higher the price of a stock, the larger the percentage of the index it will represent. Therefore, by definition, a market capitalization weighted index will automatically own too much of the overpriced stocks and too few of the bargain priced ones. Of course, equally weighted indexes will also include plenty of valuation errors, but since all stocks are weighted equally, these errors will be random in contrast to the systematic errors inherent in market capitalization weighting. The way you can tell how much capitalization weighting costs investors is to compare these indexes to equal weighted indexes of the same stocks. Based on the returns during the past 40 years, equal weighting has beat market capitalization weighting by about 2% per year. One problem with equal weighting is that stock number 500 is much smaller than stock number 1, and if too many people tried to do equal weighting, the amount of buying in the smaller stocks would distort their prices. Additionally, because prices are always changing, there are more transaction costs in maintaining an equal-weighted index. Because of these problems, Rob Arnott came up with a fundamentally based index, the RAFI-FTSE Index, which weights companies based on the size of their sales, book value, cash flow, and dividends rather than their market capitalization. Because the weighting factors used in the index are correlated to company market capitalization, larger market capitalization companies will account for a larger percentage of the total index. And since price is not involved, errors are also random, similar to an equal-weighted index, and the index performs about 2% better than capitalization-weighted indexes.
So the fundamentally based index does about as well as an equal-weighted index, but it can handle more money.
That is exactly right. We thought we could provide significant additional improvement by creating an index that allocated more money to cheaper stocks. All the existing value indexes, such as the Russell Value Indexes, are capitalization weighted. For example, the Russell 1000 Value Index will take a subset of the Russell 1000 companies, usually 650 stocks, that have the lowest price-to-book ratios and whatever other value factors they look at, but then they weight those stocks by market capitalization. In contrast, we are placing more weight on the cheaper companies, which is quite a different thing. We have found that by constructing an index this way, we could create an index that, over the past 20 years, would have beaten the S&P 500 by an average of 7% per year with the same beta and volatility. In addition to indexes, we have put together more select funds with around 100 of the cheapest stocks, also weighted by cheapness. What is interesting is that in the first 6 months of this year, our Value Select Fund, which invests in U.S. equities, was number one in its category out of about 1,300 funds, and our Select International Fund was the single worst fund in its category out of about 400 funds. We were both the very best and the very worst following the exact same strategy in different markets, and I found that fascinating.
What is the implication of that?
The Value Select Fund, which was the best performing fund in its category, beat the market by only 5%, while the Select International Fund, which was the worst performing fund in its category, underperformed the market by only 5%. It tells you that no one was really picking stocks. If we can be number one out of 1,300 by outperforming by only 5%, and the last place fund out of about 400 in another category by underperforming by only 5%, it means that almost everyone must be index hugging.
You run both large and small cap funds. Do you believe there is more opportunity in small cap stocks?
Although I don't believe the small cap anomaly exists within the Russell 3000, I do still think it is very important to look in the small cap universe because lesser followed companies are more likely to be misvalued. Those misvaluations can consist of both undervaluations and overvaluations, so there may not be any directional bias on average. But that does not take away from the fact that the small cap sector may be a particularly fertile ground to look for undervalued stocks because it is less followed.
What is the story behind the Value Investors Club you started?
In 1999, we had one of the best ideas I had seen in a long time in our portfolio. We thought we were one of the few investment firms on the street to have uncovered this opportunity. One of my partners, John Petrie, had found a posting on a Yahoo message board that had precisely analyzed the same situation that we thought we were such geniuses to have figured out. It was a complicated capital structure with lots of interesting parts. If you analyzed it correctly, you found it was a company that was trading at half its cash value with a good business attached to it, but it was very hidden. Yet here was someone on a Yahoo message board who had nailed it. John and I had the same reaction. Well, apparently there is intelligent life out there. We agreed that it would be interesting to put together a group of these guys who would share ideas with each other. We came up with the idea of pre-qualifying people to join the group. I had been teaching at Columbia for a number of years. The only way you could join was to submit an investment write-up on a specific company that would have received an A-plus in my class at Columbia. Perhaps only two or three students in my class achieve this grade each year, and they are a group of pretty smart people. So we really set the bar quite high.
Who would judge whether the original submission was good enough to warrant entry into the club?
Back then I did, along with my partner John Petrie, who co-founded the club with me.
How many people are part of the club?
We limit it to 250 members.
You must get a ton of submissions from people who want to join the club.
We do. A lot of them are good, but we are looking for the great ones.
But how do you find time to go through them?
Originally, I helped, but now a board consisting of John Petrie and a number of managers who we are close with handles that job. The people on the board are anonymous. We are the only ones who know who they are.
Has the club been a good source of ideas over time?
Yes, and one of the nice benefits has been that we have met incredibly talented people. We even helped some of them start their own funds. The people we backed are not big names. They are simply people who are passionate about investing. Most of them have chosen to run smaller amounts of money and get higher rates of return rather than build a big business.
So a lot of the members are hedge fund managers.
We originally wanted individuals. Actually, the first person who inspired this idea, the one who had posted his analysis of a complicated trade on a Yahoo message board, had a job working in a supermarket. He is a brilliant guy, and he is now working as an analyst. The people in the club have varied backgrounds. Although we had envisioned it as a club for individual investors, it quickly attracted a lot of professionals who wanted to share in the ideas. About half of the 250 members in the club are professional managers.
Once people are accepted into the Value Investors Club, do they still continue to post new ideas? What is the incentive for them to do so?
There are no membership fees, but we require each member to submit 2 idea write-ups per year and to assign a rating to 20 other ideas. If you are willing to share your best ideas, then you can stay in. If you're not, you are asked to leave.
Is the website only visible to the 250 club members?
Right now, for teaching purposes and to attract talent, we do allow non-members to have access to posted ideas with a 90-day lag or access with a 45-day lag if they register. Since the ideas are value-based, many of them are still timely even after these lags.
What are the 3 biggest mistakes investors make?
First, succumbing to emotions. They tend to make investment decisions based on an emotional response to price action or what they read in the papers or hear on the news. Second, investing without knowledge. If you can't value a company, you have no basis on which to invest. Valuing a company is pretty hard, and probably no more than 1% or 2% of investors have the ability to properly value companies. You can't buy companies for a lot less than they are worth unless you can figure out what they are worth in the first place. Third, placing too much weight on the recent past performance of managers. We inadvertently created an interesting experiment that vividly demonstrated the impact of investor errors. After I wrote the little book that beats the market, we set up a website called MagicFormulaInvesting.com. At the time, I wasn't planning on managing outside capital, but many investors who read the book asked for help in executing the strategy. Since I had always been fascinated by the idea of a benevolent brokerage firm that allowed people to pick their own stocks from a limited list of pre-selected names based on value, we teamed up with Blake Darcy, who had founded DLJ Direct, to set up that type of brokerage firm. Investors were also encouraged to pick at least 20 or 30 stocks, so they got the average instead of being overly dependent on a few stocks. Blake suggested that we also add a checkbox that allowed investors to choose the option of having us manage the portfolio rather than picking the stocks themselves. Less than 10% of the people decided to choose my original idea of doing it themselves, and over 90% just checked the box for us to do it for them. We tracked how the individual investors who managed their own portfolios from the exact same list of stocks did versus the automatic portfolios we constructed. The self-managed accounts underperformed the professionally managed accounts by over 25% in the first 2 years. I thought that was fascinating. We had effectively created a control group experiment. Here are the people who did it themselves, and here are the people who did it automatically. Both groups had the same principles and the exact same list of stocks, but letting investors make their own decisions destroyed all the outperformance.
Why did they do so much worse?
There are a number of reasons that are probably common to most individual investors. They took their exposure down when the market fell. They tended to sell when individual stocks or their portfolios as a whole underperformed. They did much worse than random in selecting the stocks from our pre-screened list. Probably because by avoiding the stocks that were particularly painful to own, they missed some of the biggest winners.
What was your worst mistake?
We found a business, Key3 Media, that had a great return on tangible capital employed and great operating leverage. It was a trade show company that used to run Comdex, the largest technology trade show. They would rent space in Las Vegas for their shows at $2 per square foot and re-rent it for $62. The company was an impending spin-off that was part of Ziff Davis. Because of a special situation that allowed us to create long exposure in the stock at $3 per share before the spin-off, which was a very cheap price, we took a 10% position in it. Several months later, it IPO'd at $6 per share, giving us a quick double on the stock. Within a few more months, the stock price doubled from the IPO level, so at that point, the single stock had quadrupled from our entry-level price and grown to about 40% of our portfolio. The business started to falter a little, but the worst loss came when the company made a large acquisition 2 days before 9/11. After 9/11, people stopped traveling. The operating leverage of renting space at $2 and re-renting it at $62 worked in reverse when they couldn't re-rent the space. Their profits went down almost dollar for dollar with the decline in revenues. In addition, they had leveraged up to make their acquisition. By the time we completely liquidated our position,